Good morning and welcome to you diehard leukemia fans who are here so early in the morning to listen to this symposium, Evolving Paradigms in AML. I'm Farah Dravandi from MD Anderson, and I have a very esteemed panel with me, and we are going to talk about some of the new therapeutic opportunities in acute myeloid leukemia. So I'm going to briefly go over the where we are in leukemia, and then the colleagues will expand on some of the topics that I go over in the overall review. As you know, we have considered leukemia as a have you always considered biology of leukemia important in terms of decision making? We have used cytogenetics as a predictor of outcome using traditional cytotoxic chemotherapy. And more recently, with the availability of more sensitive assays, we have identified a number of molecular mutations, which are particularly important with patients with normal karyotype, but also in other subtypes of AML. And we're now actually moving towards an era that we can actually start thinking of leukemia as a constellation of a number of different specific entities, and this is important because we already are developing specific therapeutic strategies for some of these entities. And this is also important because the molecular aberrations are helping to refine our predictors and classification systems, as you see here in the recent European Leukemia Net classification. And also, it's also important to note that we are beginning to look at allelic burden, as you see with FLT3, although this is still a bit controversial, but I think this is the way of the future, and we start looking at different allelic burdens of mutations in disease prognostication. In a younger AML, as you know, we have made progress over the years, and this has really been by tweaking the doses of chemotherapy and perhaps by using a third drug. The only third drug that has really withstood the time is gemtuzumab, that is now known to be very effective in at least core binding factor leukemias and possibly intermediate risk leukemias. And we also know that this entity, therapy-related or secondary AMLs, tend to have a very poor prognosis, but we now have specific strategies that I think Dr. Garcia-Manero will go over. This is CPX351, which has been shown to be associated with improved survival and is now approved for this specific population of patients. Going back to the molecular entities, FLT3 mutations are exist in about 30% of patients, and Dr. Stone, I'm sure, will expand on this, but there are a number of FLT3 inhibitors that have been developed, and the RATIFY trial led to the approval of midostaurin because it improved the survival of patients, younger patients with AML with FLT3 mutation who receive 3+7+ midostaurin. But there are now more effective and more potent FLT3 inhibitors such as quizartinib and gilteritinib, and perhaps these drugs will be available in the near future and will improve our armamentarium for treating FLT3 mutated AML. I'm going to go over IDH inhibitors at length, but this is a population of patients which account for about 20% of AML patients, and now we have specific drugs for. And also of a lot of interest is the BCL2 inhibitor venetoclax, which you will hear about throughout the meeting and this morning later, which is showing promising activity in various areas. I think minimal residual disease is very important to think about. There are various assays to use to assess minimal residual disease or measurable residual disease. This important paper from the Hovan group in New England Journal of Medicine showed that if you have the non-CHIP mutations, non-DNMT3A, TET2, or ASXL1, persisting at a time of remission, it is highly associated with higher likelihood of relapse and worse survival. And you can actually use these assays together. This is with flow as well as NGS. You can see the predictability improves significantly. And this is going to become more important when we have effective agents, such as immunotherapeutic agents that Dr. Daver is going to go over, and when we can at least try to eradicate minimal residual disease. So I think this is an exciting time in AML therapy, and we have a number of strategies available. And with that, I'm going to ask Dr. Richard Stone to come and talk about FLT3 mutations.
Farah, thank you very much. Thanks to Medicom for organizing this symposia, and certainly thanks to all of you for arising at this very early hour to hear us speak. I'll be talking about FLT3 mutations in AML. And without further ado, here's my disclosure slides. And FLT3, as most of you know, is a transmembrane tyrosine kinase that has a ligand called FLT3 ligand. But the key thing is that it's mutated in about 33% of AML patients. There's two types of mutations, a mutation in the juxtamembrane region called the length mutation, or ITD, internal tandem duplication mutation, which is the most prevalent of the two types. The other one is a point mutation in the tyrosine kinase domain. Clearly, the ITD carries an adverse prognosis. The ITD patients usually are associated with a high white count, but not always. And the ITD patients particularly are associated with a high risk of relapse and a poor overall prognosis, although in general, FLT3 AML is a chemosensitive disease, which is not, at least initially, which is not often thought of. And obviously, when FLT3 is auto-activated by a mutation, it auto-dimerizes and then signals down the MAP kinase STAT pathway to cause mitogenesis. There are a number of drugs that were made to inhibit FLT3 because this sort of discovery about FLT3 mutations occurred in the setting of the wonderful news about imatinib and CML. So figured, oh, you got an activated tyrosine kinase, inhibit it, and all will be good. Well, it's a bit more complicated in the FLT3 setting. First of all, the drugs that have been developed to inhibit this activated kinase vary in terms of potency and specificity widely. These dendrograms, which indicate what other enzymes are inhibited by the agents, you can just see by the amount of red, for example, listortinib, one of the so-called first-generation inhibitors, as was midostaurin, have a lot of red on there, which means they inhibit a lot of kinases. Midostaurin actually inhibits non-tyrosine kinases like serine threonine kinases, but quizartinib and crenolinib and gilteritinib are much more specific. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing may depend on the setting. My colleague, Dr. Levis from Hopkins, has said that maybe you want to use a non-specific FLT3 inhibitor early in the disease when it's polyclonal, and then a more specific inhibitor later in the disease when it's more addicted, when you relapse to a FLT3 mutation. And these are the second generation FLT3 inhibitors. Crenolinib, gilteritinib, and quizartinib, they're all relatively specific compared to the first-generation inhibitors. Crenolinib and gilteritinib hit both types of FLT3 mutations. Quizartinib is very specific and potent for the ITD. The drugs are given 3 times a day for crenolinib and once a day for gilteritinib and quizartinib. And they all have little quirks like crenolinib doesn't affect KIT, which maybe means it's not so myelosuppressive. Gilteritinib inhibits AXL1, which may be good or bad depending on whether you like broad specificity or toxicity. And quizartinib, as I said, is very specific. So let's, in the next 7 minutes, talk about the settings in which the FLT3 inhibitors have been and could be used, and in some cases should be used. So we'll talk about, historically, the first sort of randomized trial that was done with the FLT3 inhibitor was done in the salvage setting. The trial was led by Mark Levis. It investigated whether listortinib, a first-generation FLT3 inhibitor, could add to chemotherapy in terms of prolonging survival or improving remission rates in people that had relapsed FLT3 AML with an ITD. They got MEC if they had a short disease-free interval till they relapsed, or HIDAC if they had a longer disease-free interval, and they get listartinib beginning after the chemotherapy and going on throughout the whole thing. As you can see from the right-hand Kaplan-Meier curve, there was absolutely no effect on survival by adding listartinib. This was disappointing, but Dr. Levis went on to show that many of these patients, in fact, most of them, did not achieve sufficient levels of FLT3 inhibitory activity in their plasma by an assay he calls the PIA, plasma inhibitory activity assay. Did not achieve sufficient FLT3 inhibitory activities in the plasma, so maybe the drug failed due to pharmacologic rather than other reasons. Arog is the maker of a drug called crenolinib, which I mentioned is given 3 times a day. As you'll see in a second, it does have activity in the relapse refractory setting as a single agent, but it's being used in a similarly designed, if you will, relapse refractory trial with the backbone chemotherapy being mitoxantrone and relatively high-dose Ara-C. And it's placebo or crenolinib. So we'll see if this more bioavailable, more specific and potent inhibitor will affect the outcome of patients with relapsed AML given chemotherapy. Remember this in a few minutes when we talk about single-agent use of FLT3 inhibitors in the relapse refractory setting. Interestingly, this trial does not have another arm with the crenolinib alone, which probably would have been interesting. So what about with induction up front? That is where we have the one approved agent. But before I talk about that agent, I'll mention sorafenib, which is an older drug compared to even midostaurin in terms of its use. It's approved, as many of you know, in hepatocellular carcinoma and renal cancer. And Dr. Avandi here was one of the first, as he always is, one of the first users of sorafenib in the setting of AML. We'll talk about two trials. The first one was IA, MD Anderson IA plus sorafenib. There was a high complete remission rate. And then that was taken by the SAL group in Germany, and they used chemotherapy plus or minus sorafenib in older adults with AML, and that was another failure. It was not effective in prolonging event-free or overall survival, and it was toxic. But then another German group led by Christopher Rohlig did a trial with the same design, except it was in younger patients. It was not restricted by FLT3 mutation status, and it was a positive trial in that it prolonged event-free survival. No effect on overall survival for reasons that I can't quite tell, but even though it affected overall survival positively, and we like that, it's not really used commonly as an upfront agent. Maybe that's because of the RATIFY trial, which was a trial in which midostaurin, another first-generation nonspecific FLT3 and kinase inhibitor, was added to chemotherapy or placebo, and that was given induction, consolidation, and in maintenance if you didn't get a transplant in the meantime. And the results, as you may know, showed that there was a 22% reduction in the risk of death with a significant p-value for those who were given midostaurin compared to placebo. There are lots of other interesting findings from this trial that I don't have time to discuss. The median overall survival was tripled, but do not look at that because it's not really statistically valid. Look at the hazard ratio and look at the curves. So you can see it wasn't a home run, but it was an important, I would say it was a double. Addition of lastartanib to frontline chemotherapy was tried by my UK colleagues led by Steve Napper. The lastartanib, which was that drug that Levis used in that relapse trial, now was used by the Brits in the upfront setting. Chemo plus or minus lastartanib should have worked, right? Didn't work. But if you look at the fine print, you'll see that lastartanib did work by prolonging event-free and overall survival in patients who had significant levels of FLT3 inhibitory activity in their plasma. So again, this drug has some pharmacologic problems. Also, if you got azoles, which increased the FLT3 inhibitor level, the patients benefited. So it was a negative trial, but didn't really demolish the concept of using a FLT3 inhibitor in upfront setting. And there, the other FLT3 inhibitors are each being tested in the same setting. The Quantum First trial is designed similarly to the RATIFY trial. It's a chemo plus quizartinib or chemo plus nothing. The crenolinib trial is, I think, a very important trial because that's going to test whether using a specific inhibitor up front is a good idea compared to midostaurin plus chemotherapy. Hopefully they'll pull that off. And the Astellas folks are thinking about doing a similar trial of chemo gilt versus chemo midostaurin. So single agent at relapse. This is an important place to look at because we have three second-generation drugs, all of which have activity, the first one of which is crenolinib, which does work both in people that have been exposed to prior tyrosine kinase inhibitors and works even better in those who are tyrosine kinase naive. As I said, that's not being conducted as a single agent in the relapse refractory setting. But the next two are quizartinib, which Jorge Cortez, one of these guys' colleagues, did an important trial showing that there was a significant response rate for quizartinib as a single agent in relapse refractory ITD patients. And the QuANTUM-R was really a key trial, which has just been presented by Dr. Cortez at the European Hematological Association meeting recently. And it was basically quizartinib versus dealer's choice chemo if you relapse refractory FLT3 ITD. And the primary endpoint was overall survival. And indeed, the overall survival was prolonged with a significant p-value. And as you can see here, a 12-month survival of 27% in the quiz-treated patients and 20% in the chemo patients. So that's probably going to be approved as a single agent in relapse refractory AML, FLT3 mutant, as will gilteritinib. Dr. Pearl led a trial of single agent gilteritinib in relapse refractory AML, pretty high response rate, similar to quizartinib. This one hits both the ITD and the TKD. The trial comparing gilteritinib to chemotherapy, similar design to the prior trial I showed, probably also positive, The way we know that is because a press release was released by the company saying that you could get there was going to be an approval, NDA filed, and the FDA was going to review the application for this drug as a single agent in relapse, FLT3 AML. Low-dose chemo upfront and relapse, very interesting idea. We have a lot of combination with hypomethylating agents. Again, Dr. Ravandi was one of the first people to combine a hypomethylating agent with a FLT3 inhibitor, in this case, sorafenib. This regimen is still used a lot in people that aren't considered good chemo candidates. The response rate was appreciable. And another MD Anderson colleague, Dr. Swaminathan, led a trial of quizartinib plus azacitidine or low-dose cytarabine. And if you just look at the overall response rate of 69%, you can see that this combination of FLT3 inhibitor plus low-dose chemotherapy led to response rates as high as you'll hear about with venetoclax and hypomethylating agents. So interesting combination. Need to follow that up. And after allo stem cell transplant, less data, a bunch of trials with both old and newer agents in the post FLT3 inhibitor transplant setting trying to prevent relapse. There's data that sorafenib and quizartinib do prevent relapse in very small trials, but the key trials, the gilteritinib versus placebo in the pre-relapse post FLT3 mutant AML transplant setting, and that's a BMT-CVN-sponsored trial, and hopefully all patients in America will go on that. So in summary, midostaurin's approved as a agent to be used with initial chemotherapy in FLT3 mutant patients. Does it work because it inhibits FLT3 or other things? We'll have to find out. Novartis is sponsoring a chemo plus or minus midostaurin trial in wild-type FLT3 patients. We need to learn more about our potent and selective inhibitors in our relapse patients, and we'll have to learn more about using these drugs with hypomethylating agents in the post-transplant setting. So that was a whirlwind tour of FLT3 inhibitors in AML.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you, Farhad, for this opportunity. So I was given the task to talk about three different compounds, CPX, ABT-199, and subsequently prasinostat, so that's quite a bit in 10 minutes. This is in the context of high-risk AML, basically therapy-related secondary disease. So for this group of patients, I guess there's different modalities that you could use in the current standard of care type of perspective, like high-dose RAC, intensive chemotherapy approaches, or more commonly, in my practice at least, the use of hypomethylating agents. Some people, particularly in Europe, like to use low-dose RAC combinations. Now we have a CPX351 approved, at least in North America, and of course, the investigational clinical trials. I think everybody in the room, if they are here at 6:30 in the morning, know that this is a particularly difficult group of patients where the expectations of survival are quite poor. And it doesn't seem from the slide I'm showing you from a recent analysis from Dr. Bodu and Dr. Kadia here at MD Anderson that the survival has been really modified or affected by any of these particular modalities, except maybe in green on the CPX curve. So let's start with CPX351. The question is, what is this compound? Actually, this is basically a liposome delivery molecule that allows you to actually provide the leukemia cells with a fixed ratio of your cytarabine and donorubicin in a fixed structure. So the concept here is that you have a more efficient vehicle to provide therapy to specific sites of disease, in this case, the leukemia blast. And as you know, this drug was approved in 2017 for the treatment of patients with therapy-related acute myelogenous leukemia. Actually, the program or the development of this compound followed three major studies that you see in this slide, like is typical for this type of process, phase one, where the dose was defined or the MTD was defined as 100 units per square meter. Then this was followed by a phase two study. It was a kind of global AML trial that actually allow these investigators to identify perhaps a subset of patients with AML that could benefit the most from this therapy, and that served as the basis for the phase three trial that led to the approval of this compound. This slide shows the schema of the clinical trial that was designed to test this hypothesis of comparing CPX351 versus a standard 7+3 chemotherapy. And then basically you see that the key eligibility criteria was for previously untreated patients with AML, ages 60 to 75. Of course, this individual should be able to tolerate some form of intensive chemotherapy with adequate performance. And then they were randomized to the investigational compound, CPX, versus a standard of care with the 7+3 therapy. And it's typical with this type of approach, two induction programs were allowed and then continue on some form of consolidation chemotherapy afterwards if they had achieved some type of response. Overall, this was a very positive trial. Here you see the comparison in terms of responses, both CR or CR plus CRI. CRI, as you know, refers to these patients that do not fully recover their platelet count, and it's in favor of CPX 351. So the complete remission rate with the investigational agent was a little bit over 37%, compared to 25% for those patients with the 7+3. And if you combine both the CR and CRI, obviously, you see it's almost 50% with CPX versus a little bit over 30% for those patients with the 7+3 type of approach. Of course, that's important, but what you need to see whether this translates into improved survival or not with this type of approach. And here they are showing you plots of event-free survival comparing CPX versus 7+3. And as you can see, this was in favor also of the investigational compound of this study with a hazard ratio of around 0.74. Another issue that is critical is actually if there is a difference in terms of early mortality. There are different ways to compute this, either 30-day mortality or 60-day mortalities. And as you can see in the slide there, this actually trend in terms of less toxicity or less mortality with the investigational compound in this randomized clinical trial. And then the key question is, does this really improve overall survival? And again, if you see the slide here, there's a significant improvement in survival with CPX versus 7+3 with a hazard ratio of a little bit less than 0.7 that was highly significant. So I think these are important numbers because it's really comparing what will be considered a standard of care type of therapy with a new modality with a significant improvement in survival in this group of patients. But what I think is very interesting from this trial is that there is an effect in terms of the number of patients or the outcome of those patients that went to transplantation with this particular outcome. And I think actually that if you look at this data in its totality, most of the benefit actually goes through or from those patients actually that eventually achieved or went to bone marrow transplantation. And the question is why, you know, these patients do so well with this modality. And I think this is something that needs to be explored further in future studies. Of course, this prior intervention was significant, but I think that I don't think that the overall survival that we saw there with around 9 months is enough for us to say this should be 100% considered standard of care. And there is a very large effort between the sponsor of CPX, Jazz Pharmaceuticals, and actually MD Anderson, trying to develop a platform of potential doublet combinations combining CPX with maybe some of the targeted therapies and others that Dr. Stone was discussing earlier. So I think we're going to see a lot more clinical activity with that compound right now. The second agent that we are going to discuss is one that I think is going to be, or many of us think is going to be very, very important in acute myelogenous leukemia and also potentially myelodysplastic syndrome. And this is venetoclax or ABT-199. As you know, this is a compound that is approved for patients with chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And it was tested also in AML through the efforts of Dr. Konopleva at MD Anderson. So as a single agent, as in contrary to what you see in CLL, this drug has modest single agent activity. And you see that on the left panel on your slide. Now, there are some specific molecular subsets of this disease, for instance, those with IDH mutations, where this compound by itself may have a little bit of a higher response rate. And this is something important when you use this compound in your patients. But what really got our interest, and I think what's really going to be transformative, is this concept of combinations of this agent that modulates apoptosis with hypomethylating agents. And this has been done both with esacitabine and decitabine, and these are studies, again, done by Dr. Konopleva and Dr. DiNardo at MD Anderson. And the data, I think, is really spectacular. So this is a plot that summarizes a response rate by patient subgroups. So you can look at cytogenetic risk, whether they have AML, age, etc. And basically, you're seeing responses that are significantly over 60%. And importantly, in this older subset of patients with very high risk features, you know, complete remission rates that are between 30 to 40% in all subsets. So we think this is important data. But what is really more important, actually, is the durability of these responses and the fact that this combination is truly affecting the natural history of this disease by providing a survival that is quite significant. If you look at the slide here, you know, we're talking almost a 16 to 17-month median survival. Compare that with the prior data we saw with the intensive chemotherapy type of approach. So for sure, this is an agent and an approach that is going to have a fundamental role in this disease. It's also interesting that the investigators that are leading these efforts are able to separate specific molecular subsets that may predict for really outstanding outcomes, or, you know, realize that some of these other subgroups, perhaps those with a P53 mutation, even if they have a little better outcome compared to what the standard will be, is still a group that we need to work with a little bit more with perhaps other combinations. Now, the first line of studies are with the hypomethylating agents, but there are other studies going on. One that is going to be very important, actually, is this combination of low-dose RSC with ABT-199. And I think this is actually kind of a very smart doublet that probably will lead to very easy approval of this compound, because in our experience, the activity of low-dose RSC in this context is pretty low. And the data that Dr. Wei from Australia has shown is actually quite significant if you combine venetoclax with low-dose RSC. And the next goal also will be, for instance, to combine this not just with low-intensity modalities, low-dose RSC or hypomethylating agents, but actually with a standard high-dose RSC type of approaches. And this is actually the design of a trial combining a FLAC-IDA with ABT-199 that could be a really powerful and robust form of induction chemotherapy. There is really a potential rationale to combine this agent with multiple other agents in different diseases. And this is a slide that Dr. Konopleva gave me showing some of the ongoing and planned clinical trials. So as you can see, this is probably one of the largest research portfolio I've seen for a single agent, reflects the interest and the potential activity of this compound. And in the last couple of minutes, I'd like to go through a combination that that is kind of in the background. I don't know if a lot of people in the room are following the story, but it's kind of interesting and it's dear to me because I helped in development of this compound. So prasinostat is a second-generation histone deacetylase inhibitor that we developed at MD Anderson with a group in Singapore, both as a single agent, first in MDS, where the drug actually did not show improvement in terms of survival in a randomized trial. But interestingly, this data in AML presented at ASH a couple of years ago led to an ongoing major phase 3 trial that is now going through basically almost every continent in the world. So here what we did was a small pilot trial of 50 patients combining azacitidine with prasinostat. You know the hypothesis that these two epigenetic drugs are synergistic, and we tested this in a group of patients with AML using a standard dosing of azacitidine, and the dose that we have derived with a number of phase 1, 2 trials at MD Anderson using this compound, prasinostat, at a dose of 60 milligrams orally three times a day. And then in terms of the role endpoints, and we had some stopping rules in the study, the first thing that we saw is that we were achieving a response rate of around 50%, a little bit over that, with 42% of these patients achieving complete response rates. This is actually a really high response rate if you compare that with prior doublets with HDAC inhibitors and with the hypomethylating agents as a single agent. Of course, there were some subsets that did better. Those with worse cytogenetic characteristics did a little bit worse than those that more intermediate group. But what was really interesting from this pilot trial is in the slide here that the median survival that we saw in this trial was actually close to 20 months. That is similar to what you just heard with the ABT type of combination, with 62% of these patients being alive at 1 year. So this is very intriguing data. It's in the only data with actually the HDAC inhibitors that has this durability of survival. So the study actually is now ongoing in multiple countries. It's actively accruing, and I think it's going to be, again, perhaps the last chance for an HDAC inhibitor to prove its value in combination with an HDAC inhibitor. And then to finish, my summary slide, very simple. I think it's obvious that CPX351 is a new approach that is approved, at least in North America, for patients with high-risk AML, particularly also in the older setting. I think although ABT-199 is not approved, it's going to be an asset that is going to transform the care of our patients with leukemia, not just AML, MDS, and other diseases. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens finally with this prasinostat trial that hopefully will be completing in the next few months. And with that, Farhad, again, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Avandi and the Medicom team for the invitation. So I'm going to go through some of the immune therapies. So when we talk about the immunotherapies, I think there's two big groups that we look at. We have the antibody-based drug conjugates. These are usually antibodies that target particular antigens on leukemia surface, and these are usually linked to either a bacterial or a chemical toxin. These are a direct way of cytotoxicity. And then you have what we call the T-cell-based therapies. These include bispecific antibodies, immune checkpoints, CAR T-cells, and vaccines. So those are the two kind of sections of the talk that I'm going to give. So first, talking about the targeted antibodies, I think most of the focus now has been on antibody-drug conjugates. We haven't been focusing much in the recent times on the naked antibodies because we haven't seen a good level of activity in past trials with these agents. There's a number of targets emerging. I think the two best-known ones are CD33, CD123. As you know, there is a drug approved, a CD33 antibody-drug conjugate with the bacterial toxin calicheamicin. This is gemtuzumab ozogamicin, also called Mylotarg. There are other CD33-targeted ADCs as well as bispecifics that are in development. And for CD123, at this time, there's nothing approved, but as you can see, there are a number of agents in active clinical development in phase 1-2 studies. And there are some new targets. One of them especially that I think could be interesting is called CLL-1 or CLEC-12. This seems to have a more specific distribution on the mature AML blast with less expression on hematopoietic stem cell based on some preclinical data published by our German colleagues. And there are ADC as well as bispecific approaches that are targeting this now in clinic. So gemtuzumab has had a very long history. I'm not going to go through the full details, but as you know, it was previously approved in the United States based on large phase 2 studies, and unfortunately, a confirmatory phase 3 in the frontline setting combining gemtuzumab with induction chemotherapy did not show survival benefit, and there was some concern for increased early mortality, 4-week mortality. There were issues with the trial, and a lot of discussions and reviews have been written, concerns with the dosing as well as the early mortality in the control arm being lower than what would be expected for standard induction. But nonetheless, the drug was withdrawn from the market in 2010. Now, in parallel, a number of European studies, actually 5 large randomized studies, were initiated in the early or mid-2000s, and all of these looked at different induction-based combinations with gemtuzumab. One of the big differences compared to the U.S. studies where most of these used a lower fractionated dose of gemtuzumab, usually 3 milligrams per meter square, either once when it was given in combination with FLAG-IDA-like regimen in the British MRC phase 3s, or 3 times as was given the Alpha-0701 studies when it was given on day 1, 4, and 7, but this was with 3+7. What was seen, and this is a very nice meta-analysis published in Lancet Oncology a few years ago, was there was an improvement in EFS as well as OS across the board. There was no increased early 4-week or 8-week mortality that was seen previously in the U.S. cooperative study. And actually, the most striking findings that are going to be discussed later in the AML session, there's going to be a debate on this with Dr. Robos and Dr. Walters, was that the benefit seemed to be the most in core binding factor. And indeed, at MD Anderson, our standard and best regimen that we've published on has been FLAG-IDA with gemtuzumab in core binding factor, giving us about 85% 4-year-plus survival rates. There is some benefit in the intermediate group. It is statistically significant, clinically maybe not of great impact yet, but this is a reasonable option even for the intermediate group, of course, after taking out FLT3, for which Dr. Stone mentioned there is a standard FLT3 inhibitor. So this was the approval of gemtuzumab in the United States by the FDA. It was approved in the frontline setting to be used in combination with induction. Very important, it was approved at the lower dose, 3 milligrams per meter square. This was predominantly based on the Alpha-0701 study, which used gemtuzumab with 3+7 on day 1, 4, and 7. It also was approved in the frontline setting as a single agent in patients above 75 years of age who were not considered candidates for intensive chemotherapy, and there are very specific parameters for what would be considered non-candidates for intensive chemo. In this situation, this was based on a large Italian study that randomized patients in frontline setting to gemtuzumab versus investigator choice therapy. In the end, the median survival was 5 months versus 2.5 months for the gemtuzumab. So this is a reasonable option, but I think, as Dr. Garcia Manero mentioned, we are much more interested in things such as the HMA or low-dose RSC with venetoclax. And there also is an approval as a single agent in relapse refractory AML. I think this is one that's causing a lot of confusion in the community. We get a lot of calls about this. It can be used as a single agent. There are efforts to combine with HMA. I think in reality, we think the way this will be used in a lot of trials we're developing at MD Anderson is in combination with newer agents such as Vyxeos or with venetoclax. But I think in the frontline setting, in the core binding factor, and possibly in the intermediate, that probably is the best way this drug can be used. CD123 is another very important target. It is expressed heavily on AML mature blasts as well as in AML stem cells, but also is expressed on the hematopoietic progenitor cells. There are a number of CD123 trials that went into development. Some of these are on hold. There are some newer ones, such as immunogen compounds targeting 123 and 33, that are showing some activity and will be updated at ASH. And there are two bispecifics that are being developed at this time. One of them is a macrogenics bispecific that targets CD3, CD123, and the other one is a study with XmAb, a multicenter study that is ongoing, which has a similar approach. So bispecifics, why is there interest in this? I mean, one of the big reasons is in ALL, we do have a bispecific called blinatumomab, which is targeting CD3, which is present on the surface of T cells, and CD19, which is expressed on the surface of ALL blast. And the idea is that by bringing the T cells in close proximity to the mature leukemia blast, you activate T cells, result in cytotoxic death of the mature leukemia blast. So the similar construct, it is hoped, will be working in AML, and there are many bispecifics now in development. One of the first ones that Dr. Avandi from our group has been working on a lot is AMG-330. So Amgen is the same company that developed blinatumomab in ALL, and they're looking at a bispecific now in AML. There are some early signals of activity and responses that we have seen, and this will be shown at the ASH. One of the bispecifics, and this is the only one that I'm aware of where data actually has been released, this was at the ASH meeting last year, is a drug called flotetuzumab. This was presented by Dr. Ui, who works with Dr. DiPersio, and they did show at the higher dose levels, mind you, this was a large dose escalation, and at the dose levels below 500, they actually did not see any activity. But once they got above 500, they do see response rates about 30% as a single agent in relapsed AML. And these are people who had a median of 2 salvages. So this is quite interesting. Another thing they did see was that there was upregulation of PD-1, PD-L1. And so there is a concept that maybe you can combine these bispecifics with the PD-1, PD-L1 inhibitors. And these approaches are being looked at. Now, the last part, an area that I've been working on a lot, is the immune checkpoint and PD-1-based therapies. This is a paper that will be published in a couple of weeks where we looked at T-cell expression and expression of different immune checkpoints in a large set of about 100 AML patients, including new and relapsed. What we found, and others from Moffitt and WashU have also shown, is that the T-cell numbers are actually quite well preserved in the bone marrow in AML patients, both new and early salvage as compared to healthy donors. And among the immune checkpoints, we looked at about 10 different ones. We saw that PD-1 seemed to be one of interest, which was highly expressed in new AML and even more so in relapsed AML. And another one that might be of interest is OX40, but that's probably in a phase 1 development at this time. So this was one of the larger studies. We have started a number of different combinations with immune checkpoints. You heard some of this data at MDS. We have these in AML in combination with HMA as well as in combination with high-dose chemo and in maintenance. And now there are some phase 2 and phase 3 studies looking at this. So the overall response rate that we saw with this combination is 35%. CR/CRI is about 25%. What's really interesting is we're kind of seeing what's been seen in solid tumors and lymphoma, where there's about 15-20% patients who do not achieve the traditional IWG ELN responses, but have more than 1.5 year survival. And I think it's going to be very important in the phase 2, phase 3 studies to capture these stable disease hematological improvements, because a lot of these people actually become transfusion independent and are being outpatient. The other thing that we have seen is that the time to response is about 2 to 3 cycles. which fits with a lot of HMA combinations, and the response rate does seem to be higher than what was shown in the recent very large study with single-agent AZA. But I think more than response, what we're interested in is the survival impact that we see with these agents, and I think there's a discrepancy in the survival and the response rate. So when we looked at a historical group of patients at MD Anderson, as well as a large historical group of 600 patients from the Yale institution, we do see, especially in salvage one, that the one-year survival seems to be improved. So I think with a lot of these immunotherapies, the focus should probably be on early salvage, as well as people with lower blast and burden disease. This was shown with blinatumomab, as well as with CAR T cells, and that is where we're looking to develop these in the subsequent larger studies. Another important thing is biomarkers. We did see that people who had high bone marrow CD3 infiltration, and we were able to find a cutoff of 13% by logistic regression, had about a 55% response rate, and this made up about half of the population. So one of the ways these could be developed, and this is where some of the companies are looking at, is like we do for FLT3 and IDH, where we select patients who have high bone marrow or peripheral blood CD3. I'll talk a little bit more about this in the main session when we talk about the immunotherapy, but I think that is how these agents will be more successful rather than treating the entire population. This was some data shown in MDS by Dr. Garcia Manero, who just spoke before me. What's interesting, and this is, I think, a little bit different from what we have previously expected, is that IPI is emerging as an important drug. This was shown in AML in a post-transplant setting, published in New England Journal a couple of years ago by Dr. Matt Davids from Dana-Farber, and again, we're seeing this in MDS, that in the post-HMA failures, which, as you know, is a very, very high-risk, poor outcome group, we are getting single-agent responses and some durable survival. Granted, this is small numbers, but we're seeing this with IPI, not with NEVO. And the doublets, of course, are looking good with 60 to 70% response rates. The CAR T cells, I think, are very, very early in AML, not as mature, let's say, as in ALL. There is one published or presented data set from the City of Hope by Dr. Boudet and her group, where they did show some exciting results. Now, this is 7 patients, so we would like to see the update, but they had responses, 4 out of 7 patients, median 4th salvage, and actually when I spoke to them, the durability has been maintained at 1 year in 4 of the responders. So this is interesting. I think the study is being expanded. So in conclusion, I think gemtuzumab does have an important role, for sure, in core-binding factor. I think also reasonable approach in intermediate cytogenetic patients. In adverse cyto, most of the large studies don't show benefit. The lower dose is the dose to use. There is lower incidence of VOD, but precautions and close monitoring are still required. The bispecifics, I think, are showing some interesting activity. I think they may go very similar to ALL, where they work well in the lower burden and maybe in early salvage. And with the immune checkpoints, there are now 2 phase 3 and a phase 2 study looking at it in frontline as well as maintenance setting. I think these agents also, like the bispecific, should be used in the salvage 1 setting, and maybe we can have biomarker-driven studies like we do for FLT3 IDH, and we will see how those go. Thank you very much.
So I'm going to talk about a couple of very exciting drugs that are already available, and these are IDH inhibitors. Isocitrate dehydrogenase is a normal enzyme in the normal Krebs cycle in the cells, and it's been shown to be mutated in a number of malignancies, and in acute myeloid leukemia, there are 2 enzymes, IDH1 and IDH2, and you can see the incidence of mutations in AML in this slide, as well as this slide that shows that these mutations can occur in a number of cancers. They were first described actually in colorectal cancer, but they are also seen in glioblastoma multiforme, for example, as you see. But again, in AML, IDH2 mutations occur in about 15% of patients, and IDH1 mutations in about 7% of patients. And these are tested by assays such as PCR or next-generation sequencing. Most academic centers are now doing this, and this is available. And also a number of private laboratories also perform this. And it's very important for you to consider doing this testing both at the time of diagnosis but also at the time of relapse, because now we have effective drugs that are available for treating these patients. This is the first one, enasidenib, that was investigated initially in a phase 1-2 study. There were several cohorts in the study, relapse and refractory AML, elderly, unfit AML in front, and other hematological cancers such as MDS. But the focus is really on the relapse and refractory AML. All of these patients had to have IDH2 mutation, and the overall result of the study was very exciting because as a single oral agent, it was able to produce about 40% response rate, including about 20% complete remission. And considering that this is actually an oral and quite non-toxic, easily taken and well-tolerated, as compared to chemotherapy in relapsed refractory AML, where we see responses in the region of 30% overall, you can see that this is obviously a drug that is making an impact, at least in this subset of IDH2 mutated patients. Another important thing is, as you see, the number of complete remissions increases, or proportion of patients with complete remissions increases with time. As I mentioned, the patients can take this oral drug daily without significant problems in the majority of cases. And if you continue the therapy, you improve your responses. So you should not be giving up on the drug early and just say, well, I'm going to give it one cycle, and if it doesn't work, I'm going to move on. So you can actually see responses after 2-3 months of therapy and even longer. Obviously, the patients who have achieved a complete response tend to do best, as you see this with every drug. You can see the overall survival is actually quite impressive in patients with complete response in the red line. In terms of toxicity, the one that you need to be aware of is the IDH differentiation syndrome, which is actually somewhat similar to ATRA differentiation syndrome. Patients develop sometimes leukocytosis, fever, shortness of breath, pulmonary infiltrates, chest X-ray changes, and it is actually managed very similarly using steroids, and perhaps if you need to, by holding the drug and reducing the dose later. Now, the second drug is ivosidenib, which is an IDH1 inhibitor, and it was also investigated in a similar phase 1-2 trial. Again, several cohorts, mainly patients with relapse and refractory IDH1 mutated AML, but also untreated, unfit patients, as well as other diseases such as MDS. The majority of patients that are enrolled were in the relapse and refractory. The phase one actually found the dose of 500 milligrams daily as the recommended phase two dose. And the data that I'm showing is for the relapse and refractory patients who were treated with the recommended phase two dose. And you can see this is a population with a median age of 67, but as low as 18 and as high as 87, about two-thirds of them were de novo, and about a third secondary AML. As you can see, the median number of prior therapies were 2, but as high as 6, and a number of patients had had prior allogeneic stem cell transplant. This is the co-mutations that existed with the IDH1 mutation, and this is important because some of these are already being shown to be a mechanism of potential resistance. For example, presence of RAS mutations does, or FLT3 mutations does portend a lower response to the IDH inhibitors. The adverse events that reported within this study were really what you see with any population of relapse and refractory AML, who is myelosuppressed, and there are really infections and bleeding issues. But also differentiation syndrome, as was seen with the enasidenib or IDH2 inhibitor, is also seen in about 10% of patients with ivosidenib. Again, similar features, fever, shortness of breath, unexplained fever, pleural effusions, and pulmonary infiltrates. And again, it's managed by using corticosteroids and perhaps, if necessary, by interrupting treatment. But you can see in the green box that even when they develop this differentiation syndrome, patients can actually have excellent responses. And as you can see, there are 5 patients with CR and a number of patients with CRI. So developing differentiation syndrome should not make you move on to something else. You should persist, and the patients may benefit in terms of response. With ivosidenib also, there was an overall response rate of about 32%, including about 24% complete response, which is, again, very impressive for an oral non-toxic agent, which the patient really takes at home and has little other toxicity that we are commonly seeing. We commonly see with cytotoxics in the relapse and refractory setting. Again, with this drug, you need to persist and continue the therapy, and the patients stay on the therapy, and some of the responses can occur after a couple of months or 3 months. And you can see the patients can stay on the drug for a lengthy period of time and improving their responses. And patients who achieve a complete response do get a significant overall survival benefit. Some of these patients obviously will go on to have a transplant, but without even transplant, patients can stay on this drug and remain in complete remission for a lengthy period of time. And more importantly, transfusion independence. You can see the patients in CR almost 100% become platelet and red cell transfusion independent, but even some of the non-responders who didn't have the actual classical response criteria become transfusion independent during the course of this therapy. What about clearance of IDH mutations? I talked about minimal residual disease. Obviously, this is of something of interest. As you see with this IDH1 inhibitor study, about a quarter of the patients with CR did clear IDH mutation at the time of achieving CR, and this was in this small subset of patients. It's a small number of patients, but it's still significant that you can see patients who do achieve an IDH mutation clearance at the time of remission tend to do better. And I think this will become significant in terms of measurable residual disease assessment in larger studies. How about moving on further? And there, as has been a practice with all targeted agents, we are now combining IDH1 and IDH2 inhibitors with hypomethylating agents. This is a study that combining azacitidine with either enasidenib for IDH2 mutated patients or ivosidenib in IDH1 mutated patients. Early results were reported in the last ASH meeting by Dr. DiNardo, and you can see this is a small number of patients, only 23 patients in terms of ivosidenib and even fewer in terms of enasidenib, but the response rate is actually quite impressive. So I'm sure that we will hear more about this with the expansion of the number of patients and further patients enrolled on the trial. So I think in conclusion, we are, again, as I mentioned earlier, this is an exciting era in AML therapy. There is a number of very effective agents, and some of them oral non-toxic agents. IDH-mutated patients do benefit not only in the relapse, but potentially in future when we combine these IDH inhibitors with either hypomethylating agents or with chemotherapy. And there are studies, as you see at the bottom, that are investigating these prospects. But also there are also next set of IDH inhibitors in development, such as the drug mentioned at the last line of the slide. And clearly, we are making a major impact in AML therapy with all of these agents, and it's exciting to be doing AML these days. Thank you.